for Senate number 322, Labor and House Judiciary, an act relating to the workman's compensation, providing for an effective date. I'd like to see if we can get this bill out of committee. It's scheduled for the calendar. Representative Sund here is here to explain the differences and their judiciary version. Representative Sund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not really sure I'm here to explain the differences. I can explain what's in this bill. But basically, the bill before you has been through Labor and Commerce and Judiciary. We've held about 10 days of hearings, I guess, in Judiciary. Been through it, marked it up. I think it's in a pretty good shape. There is, I'm not sure, does everybody have a handout on it?
Which handout?
This overview.
Just an overview handout of it.
Yeah. Yes, we do.
Overview is broken down into three areas, basically the injured worker-related issues, the insurer-employer-related issues, and there's some insurance factors in here. But the report that we took the bill after it came out of Judiciary and sent it off to a firm called Milliman and Robertson, which is consulting actuaries that the Labor Management Task Force had been using and we use, and we asked them to estimate the cost in this bill. And their basic they came back and said, we estimate the proposed law will reduce benefit costs slightly more than 6% relative to the current benefit levels. And they give some backup on it. And there are some qualifiers in the bill or in their report that say that they assume that the current level rates are adequate. And there is some feeling out in some parts of the community that maybe what is being paid now is inadequate rates. Don Koch from Division of Insurance testified that he felt if nothing happened, that he didn't see any increase in the insurance rates this year are at the maximum 2%. So that means that the rate structure there should be adequate now, and we should be able to see about a 6 to 10% reduction in premium dollars paid. And this bill does include a provision, I think it's in Section 44 of the bill, for a mandatory rate reduction, and that just to activate you guys to some of the more controversial sections, that probably is one that's in there. But the testimony we felt on the committee that we could at least achieve that with this bill, if not more. Yeah, it's Section 46 of the bill. But so that's kind of where it is. I could take you through there. We made about 45 amendments to the bill in Judiciary. Some of the major ones were requested by the Labor Management Task Force. And just to, I guess, explain the one big change that the committee here, it has to do with the way permanent partial disability is rated. And under the current law, parts of your body are in a schedule and parts of them are unscheduled. Head injuries, back injuries, other injuries are unscheduled. And that was a source of a lot of litigation. What we've done in here is put everything on a schedule so that there's a percentage found, a percentage of impairment of your back, and you go over to this table and you look up what it is, and that'll tell you how much money you're going to get paid. That the sort of the theory there is it's going to reduce the cost of litigation in that area. And that was one of the overall themes that the Labor Management Task Force went through, is how do we reduce the cost of litigation without trying to impact benefits too much. The benefit table was revised in Judiciary also at the request of the Management Task Force because what they had they had a factoring theory in the bill that I won't bother with the details that they figured didn't work. It made too much of an adjustment from injuries that were small and cut them down too much and moved up major injuries too high. So this changes that a little bit. Under this bill here, for example, if you lost an index finger under the current law, you would get $4,500. Under this law, you're going to get $8,100 versus if you lost, for example, if you lost hearing in both ears, under current law, you'd end up with $11,000. Under this one, you're going to get $8,100. And then under, if you get into the unscheduled injuries, head, back, hernia, heart attacks, necks, mental, multiple injuries, those are all unscheduled. And then this one here lays you out a schedule of what you would end up with. So that's kind of the major theoretical differences in the bill. The voc rehab section is capped at $10,000. And two things, you have to volunteer to go into voc rehab, and then if you do, there's a $10,000 lid. So that's kind of a cap on that side of it. The medical costs are capped in a way that we put them under usual and customary rates. UCR is the euphemism for it, but all other insurance premium dollars or insurance programs in the state use a UCR system, and workers' comp is the only one where it's an unlimited billing structure. And the testimony was that doctors really have three different billing structures in their office. One if you come in if you have an insurance claim, one if you come in and you have no insurance, and one if you come in and you're a workers' comp recipient. And we hope to reduce that down to two different schedules, one for uninsured and one for insured, and the hope that will bring down some of the medical costs. So we've capped the premiums, we've tried to control the medical costs, we put a lid on the voc rehab, and we've tried to make definite some of the injuries, the scheduled injuries, all in terms of trying to make it more definite of making a decision. The other controversial stuff have to do with, we gave the ability of the board to hire their own independent medical examiner. So if they come in with conflicting stories, the employee has one medical and the employer has the other one, the board can go out and hire an independent medical examiner to take a look and advise the board as to what he thinks is really the true situation. The theories there were as the bill came into committee, it said that the independent medical examiner to be hired by the board had to be of the same profession as the treating physician. That was a controversial issue of should the board be able to hire whoever they think is the right guy, or do they have to go by whoever the employee chose as his initial treating physician? We chose in judiciary to say the board, if we're going to give the board the authority and responsibility to hire an independent medical examiner, they should have enough knowledge and brains to hire whoever they think is appropriate. So we changed that. The other concept there was, what weight should this independent medical examiner's opinion be given? And as the bill came into judiciary, it said that the board had to accept the opinion of the independent medical examiner unless, by clear and convincing evidence, the board could find that his opinion was wrong. And the committee felt that that really was abrogating the responsibility of the workers' comp board. The workers' comp board's responsibility is to make the decision, and that their decision-making power should not be given away to some independent doctor over here. So we took that out and made that doctor's opinion of whatever weight the board wanted to give it. Our assumption is if the board chooses who they want to hire, decides they want to hire another medical exam, they are, by inference, going to probably want to listen to that guy's opinion when he comes back. And they will give whatever weight it is, but we shouldn't mandate in law that these decisions are going to be made by some independent doctor. So those are some, just giving you some highlights of where we had the major controversy in treatment, medical treatments. The bill originally, as it came in, had language in it like you couldn't have over 20 on continuous medical treatments. You couldn't have over more than 20 visits in 60 days, and not more than 4 visits a month after that. We thought that was a little bit unusual to put into a law that how many times you can go see the doctor, how many times a person wants to see you, and that there were many circumstances out there that might not fit. So what we did, we basically said there should be some guidelines in order that people can decide whether the medical fees are in line or out of line. So we just gave the authority and mandated that the board shall establish by regulation some guidelines regarding medical treatment. And we figured it was better to do it there than it was to lock it up in statute. Definition of mental injury is defined in here. That's another kind of a real hot spot, I guess. I don't have my marked up version of the bill, so I have a hard time figuring out which sections are which now, but I think that's towards the back of the bill. Page 31 is a legal issue, but there's a definition of mental injury which says that injury does not include a mental injury caused by the mental stress unless it is established that A, the work stress was extraordinary and unusual in comparison to pressures and tensions experienced by individuals in a comparable work environment, and the work stress was the predominant cause of the mental injury, and the amount of the work stress shall be measured by actual events. And this is what in the terminology came to be as mental. If you actually, I don't know if your bill is. My bill is missing a page, so I don't get on to the rest of it. But there is an attempt here to try to say that if you have a mental injury that's related to your work environment, you can show this, but if it's just mental, it's going to be the burden of proof. It's going to be on you to show that it's an injury rather than the assumption that it is. It's a tough one. We talked about it a lot. We went over the language, went over the definitions. People basically said, no, they're not really comfortable with the language, but nobody had anything better. And so we left that. The other portions of the bill are in reporting requirements. We increased the penalty sections for failure to report or filing incomplete reports. In the insurance side, and of course the insurance industry and people who have to report don't like to be told they have to be reported all, and more or less they don't like to pay higher penalties if they fail to report. But we felt getting the knowledge and the information into the system of what the real cost of the workers' comp system is an important factor. We dealt a little bit with the assigned risk pool, Mr. Chairman, and that's kind of another area that I think is probably the biggest impact on Alaska employers is trying to deal with this problem of new employers, small employers who do not have big premiums, and that's like 70% of the companies in the state of Alaska have fewer than 15 employees, that when you go into business, you have no rating history, you have no background, and you don't have a $50,000 premium to write, so you can't negotiate, so nobody out in the world wants to write your coverage. And as a result, you get assigned into this assigned risk pool because we mandate that you have to have coverage, so we order the carriers to say, well, if nobody else will write, then you carriers on a rotating basis have to pick up these people out of this assigned risk pool. Well, you get a 20% premium charged on top of your rate when you're in the assigned risk pool. So there's a lot of employees out there, small people, that have never gotten out of it, right? They pay a small premium. They have no bad work history. They have no accidents. They have a clean record, and yet they're paying a 20% premium merely because they're small. And so we tried to write a provision in here that would encourage employers to try to rate them after a couple of years, to go in and give them a rating and force them to rate them, and if they didn't rate them, they couldn't charge the premium. And then we changed the premium around a little bit so that it was a little more of an incentive if a small employer had a good track record, had a good modification factor, was better than the average, they would not have to pay such a high premium. And then if you were a small person and you did have a bad track record, you would pay more. So the people who have bad experiences are going to pay a little bit more, and the people who have good experiences are going to pay a little bit less. It's a new concept. It was not in the Senate bill. It was not in the Labor and Commerce version. And I think it's a good provision and hope we can stay with it. With that, Mr. Chairman, I know there's a lot of people here who have spent a lot of time on it in the audience. Obviously attracts a crowd. I lived with most of these people for most of the last month, so we're good friends, but I'd take any questions, or if I can't answer them, I'll see if someone here can.
Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of one general question is on my impression, and I'm not an expert in this area by far, is that one of the problems with the workers' comp system was that it was supposed to be a pretty much a litigation-free way to let workers get compensated without having to go through the courts and all. And I was just wondering if you could tell me, what does this do to reduce the number of cases that go to litigation, or what penalties are imposed on people who try to litigate the presumed benefits?
Well, you're right. The original theory was it's a no-fault system, and that we'd throw tort law out, that you don't have to prove negligence, but you only get a schedule of benefits back. And that's how it started back in the 20s and 30s. The end result is that now I think it has its own body of law, and there's almost the same players as the tort system. You know, you got lawyers, you got insurance adjusters, you got medical examiners, and it's just a different set of rules. So one of the theses of the Labor Management Task Force is if they could bring more certainty into the law, they could reduce the litigation. And the attempt in this bill, one, is to take away or schedule all the unscheduled permanent partial disability so that those would not be litigated, to establish the mental stress cases and work on that, and that's taken care of in here, to take care of the abuses of voc rehab, which were taking place, and that's covered in this bill. And in the intent section, there's some major changes. If you look at page 1, line 14 and 15, if you read that sentence, where it says, the legislature declares the workers' compensation laws must not be construed by the courts in favor of any party. That is a major change in compensation law in this state. The law now is, that's also on section 22 on page 20. If you'll take a look at that, you can see the where it says we've added a new subsection to 23.125, subject to an employer's or employee's burden of proof, a finding of fact made by the board as part of the compensation order is conclusive, unless the court finds specifically that a reasonable person could not have reached the conclusion made by the board. So we're trying to strengthen the power of the board to be the fact finder, so what the facts are found by the board are not appealable. That's basically what that section is going to do. So you're going to reduce that part of the litigation. And if they are appealable, we're basically saying that both sides are to be considered equal coming up. And in the past, we've had this what's called the humanitarian theory, that if there's doubt, the employee gets the benefit of the doubt. There's some major major changes in attempting to cut down the litigation and say, hey, what the board decides is going to be it, guys. That's it. We're going to give them authority to get an IME. We're going to, and when they put their facts down. And the other, on the hearing system, there's a process to speed up the hearings. If you look on the, look through the pages here, there's some strict section 20, I believe, of the bill on page 19 sets out this, some fairly strict guidelines on getting to the hearing. But you have to, when you, once you file a request for a hearing, on page line 22, page 19, after a hearing has been scheduled, the parties may not stipulate to a change of the hearing date or to cancel, postpone, or continue the hearing, except for good causes determined by the board. What we're basically saying is that, hey, when you ask for a hearing, you're ready to go. All the discovery is done. When you walk in, you're not going to get a continuance. And this case is going to be heard. It's going to be heard now. And what the board finds is going to be it. And so it's an attempt to just kind of go in and get it over with. So that's kind of a long answer to your question, but that issue is addressed throughout the bill.
I appreciate it. I have just a couple of specific questions on things you touched on. On that IME, and I don't really understand the issue, but I know I've gotten POMs and letters and what's going on there. And is it the case that the injured worker comes in with his position and the employer comes in with his position, and then the board hires their own physician? Is it kind of the case there are three physicians giving an opinion on what the extent of the injury is?
It's worse than that. There may be 10 physicians involved. You may have 4 physicians on the employee side. You may have an orthopedic. You may have a neurologist. You may have a vascular surgeon. You may have a psychologist. And on the employer side, you may have the same series of physicians, and they come in with very, very different. A lot of times, you know, you get medical examiners, and people are going to say about the same thing. Sometimes they're very. You wonder whether they even looked at the same person. And we've given the board to say when they look at this and they can't really figure it out, they have the authority to go out and hire whatever they want. They can hire one, or they could hire a panel of independent medical examiners to look it over. Now, we've asked them to say their review should be as restricted to just reviewing the prior diagnostic data as possible. We don't want to take the employee and subject them to another massive round of sometimes fairly painful tests. But to do what they can to come back and say, hey, this is what we think is the right thing. And my guess is they're not going to come back with a completely third alternative. They're going to come back either confirming one side or the other is the more logical way to do it. And we've given those doctors at IME immunity from suit for their opinion coming back. Not immunity for anything. If they poke needles in the guy, they're not going to get immunity from that. But for delivering their opinion to the board, nobody's going to be able to sue them. Doctors can't take after them for libel or slander, which is often the case. So we hope it'll be a good system.
This IME that gets hired, does the IME have more status? I mean, it seems like you touched on whether that the IME's opinion had more weight than either side's positions or didn't. And
In the bill that came out of Labor and Commerce, it gave the IME's opinion, basically the IME's opinion would have been, have to be followed unless there was clear and convincing evidence otherwise. And we took that out. The IME's opinion is whatever weight the board wants to give it. It's equal with any other evidence the board has. That's what's in the bill now. We just didn't feel it's right to give that authority or give that opinion any more weight than any other opinion.
Okay. Two other questions. One, I just, in looking through it, I saw something on page 13 that I didn't understand, on lines 19 through 21. Could you explain what that addition, those added lines, added words there are, say? And
yeah, that relates back to Section 5 of the bill, I think, and that's a very good point, Representative Rieger. That's a very major issue in this bill, and one that I'm not sure is going to make it. If you look at on page 3, Section 5, it says an employee who knowingly makes a false statement as to the employee's physical condition on an employment application or pre-employment questionnaire may not receive benefits under this chapter if the employer relied upon the false representation and this reliance was a substantial factor in the hiring and there's a causal connection between the false representation and the injury to the employee. What this is saying is that if an employee comes in and he has to fill out a physical condition on an application and makes a false statement, in the classic cases, he doesn't reveal he has a bad back. And the employer relying upon that puts him in the loading room to handle heavy weights or load trucks or something. As a result of handling that heavy weights, loading trucks, the person injures his back and then claims a comp claim. What this paragraph, Section 5, is saying is that if the employee knowingly makes a false statement, that you have to prove the person basically lied. Secondly, that the employer, if he knew that person had a bad back, would not have put him in that job position. And because he put him in that job position, he caused the injury. That employee is barred. It says 2026 may not receive benefits under this chapter. Basically, he is not going to be allowed to file a comp claim. That's pretty heavy-duty penalty. But the other answer came up, well, if the guy can't file a comp claim because of this, he'll just sue in tort. Right? He'll just file a normal negligence action for being injured on the job and go through the tort system. What you see on page 13... in that, where it says the liability of the employer is exclusive, even if the employee's claim is barred under 2330.020B, which we just discussed. So this is basically saying that when the employer gets sued in tort by the employee, he can assert this section here, 2330.055, exclusion of this liability, as a defense, and say this employee is barred from suing me. His sole claim is in the workers' comp. You can't sue me in tort. But then he goes to the workers' comp claim, and the employee is barred from claiming under workers' comp because he lied on his application. So it's kind of a roundabout system here, and it's one that I think is probably going to come under attack. But it's in here, and it's an attempt to get at this situation that we're laying out, where an employer just ask him what his physical condition is. The person lied, and based on that, they put him in a job where they wouldn't have. So it's pretty hard to prove it, but once it is, it's going to be cut out. Now, there is an anti-discrimination provision in this thing, too, that I can't find it right now, that allows for discrimination based on filing workers' comp claims or past actions that the employer can't discriminate. So it's kind of a balanced system here in trying to take some of the abuses out of the system.
Okay, so in short, if you've been found to be barred from a workers' comp claim because of those facts, then you cannot go after the employer under the tort system either.
Well, you can. Nobody can stop you from filing a suit, but the employer's defense is 055.
Okay, thank you. And the last question I have, could you just tell me where in the bill is the assigned risk pool stuff that you agreed to?
Page 2, Section 2, according to staff.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to get through that.
Any further questions?
Yes,
Representative Bell.
John, what do you think of the bill? Do you like it? Do you like the way it came out?
I like the version we have here. I think it's a fairly good bill. And I guess what I am afraid, my biggest fear would be that if we did a reduction in benefits and there was no reduction in premium, I think that would be a classic lose-lose situation.
That's potential?
No, I think the bill here mandates a rate reduction, so you're going to see a rate reduction of 6%. Our testimony from John Lewis, who is a national expert that was up here when the bill was first come in the legislature, he says out of this we should be able to see a 10% reduction in rates. Milliman and Robertson gave us a written report saying at least 6, could be higher to 10 if some of the soft side of this bill is implemented, and the soft side being like Section 3 of the bill, a worker place safety program. There's a lot of testimony that if you had a good worker safety program, you could reduce your rates today by 25%.
The only public comment in our packets here is a letter from the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, so I'm wondering what the final testimony on the final product of the bill was, or the final product of your meetings, were with regard to a couple of points, which I've asked you about before. One was the concern by some that the small independent businesses would suffer under the bill, that regardless of the safeguards that you discussed in relation to the assigned risk pool, that insurers would be reluctant to cover them and that it would lead to a loss of access to insurance. And then I've got another. But in relation to small business, do you have any comments on whether you were able to resolve those issues? I'm not referring to this letter. It just happens to be the letter that was in the packet.
You didn't respond to this letter?
No, sir. No. I was just mentioning that the only letter that was in the packet was that letter, so I was trying to get your comments on how the small business interests were reacting to the final product. Those people who were concerned that there would be a loss of availability of insurance under this bill to them.
I don't really think there's going to be a loss of availability. That's always an issue out there, but I don't see that really happening.
Was anything done in the draft as you went from the time a month or so ago where those comments were being made to where it got out of judiciary? Were there any particular changes in the bill that might respond to that concern and improve the odds of or reduce the odds?
I think the response that there's going to be less coverage available, less insurance available in the state if you do this or if you do that, which is normal. Probably those people make those comments probably would like to see the mandatory rate reduction in this bill out of it, and they would like to see the assigned risk pool modification provision out of it because it tells them to do something that they're not doing now. I think that's a natural reaction. We've told everybody in this bill what to do. You know, we've limited the amount of money the voc rehab people can get. We've told the doctors they have to charge UCR fees. We told the plaintiff's lawyers under current law, lawyers for the employees cannot receive any money outside of what is awarded by the board. So that's as a result, you don't see many lawyers that take on cases, especially in my town. I don't think there's anybody in my town. One of my old law partners does a little bit of workers' comp. There's very few attorneys that do plaintiffs' workers' comp. I made an attempt to try to regulate what the defense lawyers got paid. I wanted to put them under and say they could not receive any more money than what was awarded by the board. And it's a misdemeanor. If you get any more money, it's a crime under current law. And they went wild. I've never seen anything. You think they got shot in the foot or something. But they screamed all over the state that they have a constitutional right not to be regulated, that their attorney's fees were not major parts of the system. And
are you saying there's a limitation then in the bill on the plaintiff's fees?
All plaintiff's fees have to be approved by the board.
No limitation on the defendant's fees.
No, and the end result was that I finally agreed that it was real hard to regulate it because the self-insured people pay their own people to do it, right? So how do you tell them not to pay their people what they pay them? So the end result was we just asked them to report the money, and we actually found out current law requires them to report the cost of what they spend on insurance defense, on investigation, and other aspects of it. And I think it's column 22A on the settlement report, but nobody ever filled in the number. We went through 100 of them, and out of 100, only 5 had ever complied with the law. So I put a penalty provision in here that says if you fail to fill out the form accurately and completely, it's a $1,000 fine. So that was kind of the end result of that, and I'm not sure they really want to do that either. But I'm in answer to your other question, Representative Gall, what impact is this going to have on the small employer in this state? I honestly got to say I don't know. I don't know. If you can't do something with the assigned risk pool issue, I don't know that it'll have very much impact at all.
Yeah. Section here at the beginning of your overview that references the change in payments on the bottom, Section 3 compensation says change the weekly benefit amount from 200%. Is that supposed to say state's average weekly
rate? Yes.
Are you saying the average weekly wage in the state is $1,100 a week? Or is that the average benefit?
That's 200%, I think, isn't it, Jackie?
200%, yeah.
That's 200%. Yeah, what we did there is we didn't do it. The Labor Management Task Force decided to lower the top end, the max that you could get down to $700, but at the same time they raised the minimum from 110 to 154. And you get to 154 by taking the minimum wage in the state of Alaska and going by 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week. That's what you get paid. So it was an attempt to try to get more money to the poor people or the people in the low end and just cut out some of the high end. I think there was only 11 or 12 cases or something that are over $700.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's very few small people up on the upper end, so we don't think we're cutting many people out there.
Thank you, John. I've got just a couple more, Mr. Chairman or Representative Sun. What about labor? Are there people here today? There's no one signed up to testify, but I'm rather curious to know what the consensus of not only organized labor, but workers in general might have been to the extent that such testimony was given to your committee. Could you report to us?
The Labor Management Task Force, Bob Anders, who's sat on this.
Excuse me, forgive me. I was wondering what people who were not part of the ongoing process but just showed up there at the end and commented on the bill and some of the left-out parts of labor. Was there a consensus?
I'm not sure who's defined as the left-out parts of labor.
I'm sorry.
The victims of the system.
What I'm trying to say is I'm trying to avoid getting a knowledge of how the people who are vested in the bill through their ongoing participation and sense of proprietary interest. I'm sure that they eventually signed off on something and it got out of your committee, but I was wondering how the product was viewed by the observers from the labor organizations and so forth.
I can't say that I've received a lot of correspondence from people who belong to labor organizations whose leadership was at the table. I think maybe in answer to your question, if you talked about the testimony that we had, public testimony of people who have, our workers who are injured and then out in the system, they had a lot of complaints and they weren't real happy about the existing workers' compensation system. They felt they had been run through the ringer by the employers. They'd been sent to unnecessary amount of tests. They had not received enough benefits, that the voc rehab system wasn't working. They were rehabbed into jobs they didn't like. Just an ongoing set of issues, most of which I think are abuses of the system that exist out there now, and I'm not sure that this bill will solve some of those problems. This is not an end-all to solve all problems, but if there's a way an employer wants to abuse the system with a injured employee, I'm not sure that that couldn't continue under this bill here.
I guess what I'm really driving at, and I'm not sure that, I guess what I'm asking is for your opinion, unless there are people here who can testify and speak to the question. Feel that the beneficiaries of the program, you've spoken to the reduction of rates and the benefits to the employer or the potential benefits, and you've described to some extent the changes in the benefit package and the structure of benefits to the employee, but could you characterize the general testimony of people representing employees as to the final product of the bill, whether it be from the Joint Task Force or otherwise?
I think it's a better package, yeah.
And do you feel that they think so too? To the extent that you can characterize they or people who come over.
That assumes that they know what's in the package, and I think that's one of the bigger problems we have right now, that there's a lot of different versions of this bill running around.
Think that there's a need for additional scrutiny by labor? I know the bill's on the floor today, so it's sort of just a rhetorical question.
I think this bill has been as scrutinized as any bill ever has. The task force spent 15 months putting it together. I guess there are some factions that work in the labor force that were not represented on that task force.
But it's your sense of the consensus that a vote for the bill is going to be reasonably supported by all parties, is that correct?
I sure hope so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judging from my POMs, they've slowed down since you started working on this bill, so I assume that you've been doing something right on this, John. I just had a kind of a question on this rehabilitation specialist. That I looked in the statute, and before it said a qualified rehabilitation professional, and there was a definition, but pretty broad. And this rehabilitation specialist now is the department within a year, is that correct? They will come up with some provisions by regulation as far as what a rehabilitation specialist is. You mentioned earlier in your testimony that there were some problems with people getting assigned into the wrong field or whatever. Was this an attempt to address a concern that some people have had about just who a rehabilitation specialist was and the qualifications of the
theory is that the existing system is a mandatory voc rehab system, and that's not really true in the sense that's not how the statute's written, but the way it's implemented, it's you get put into a voc rehab program that you, the employee, may not have chosen. This puts it on the employee and makes it a voluntary system. They can choose whether to participate or not, and if so, what areas they want to work in. And the real threshold is, I think, you have to be rehabilitated back to a 75% of your prior wage level, if I recall. That's what it was, 60% when it came into the committee, and we raised it to 75% on the recommendation of the Labor Management Task Force. So that's a good question, and it's a big area. You know, when does the company have to stop paying your voc rehab expenses? And the answer is when you can be put back into the labor force at least 75% of the wage level that you had before you were injured. That's kind of the rough answer.
I guess,
and it is not limited to the area where you live. It's first the area of where you were injured and the area of your residence, and then the whole state, and then other states. It's a big issue.
But the question I had really was to the person that's doing the counseling or whatever you want to call it. That in the old statutes or in the statutes currently, as I said, there's a definition, but it doesn't. I don't think there's any regulations that really stipulate what that rehabilitation specialist qualifications are or any of that sort of thing. And I think in your language here, you grandfather in the existing people, and the department has to come up. Was that within a year they have to come up with a, or is it not specified?
We're creating a certification process where they got to get on a list, and I think everybody's grandfathered in for 1 year. They have to become qualified within a year.
But is there anything that stipulates what those qualifications are? It's by regulation. You're going to adopt those in the future. Is that correct?
Yeah. For the record, that's Jackie McClintock from Work Department of Labor.
Well, it says who is a certified insurance, certified by the insurance company, or how did, and who certifies the people is what I'm trying to say.
These are regular standards that are put.
Okay, I think you've answered my question. My last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with the rate reduction that you mentioned, John. And I didn't see exactly in this bill, but where it would kick in. But you said it's that you specify a 6% rate reduction, and for what year? My understanding is the rates are already set for this year, I believe. So when would that 6% reduction
Well, it's on page 32, but section 46, lines 22 through the end of the page. There is a letter from the rating commission. There's a rating commission in the state that says, with the implementation of this legislation, they would order a 5.7% rate reduction. And the assumption is it would go into effect immediately. There is an issue that came up that we didn't resolve of whether people who have existing premiums they paid are going to get a rebate back. I would assume, and that's our assumption, is that they would get a rebate back. Otherwise, it's just going to kick in for people who are writing new premiums. Like if their annual premium rolls over in July, right, they would get a new rate reduction. But we think it ought to be fair across the board. And you can read through there for the period beginning July 1, 1988 and ending January 1, 1990. And then rate filings made after the end of this year must fully reflect the legal effect of changes made to the comp system by this act. So that's kind of how we... So there's a long mechanical discussion, I guess, we could go through of how rates are filed and how they're made. But the attempt here is to say that the testimony is they should come down. They ought to come down. We ought to be sure they come down. They should go into effect on July 1st.
But the filings, the rates that are already in effect then would have to be...
They're going to be refiled. The Rating Commission will file a new set of rates effective July 1st.
Even though the rates are in effect or good for the year, they have to automatically refile with the passage of the...
Well, they've stated that they will recommend or will implement a 5.7% rate reduction, even if this section is not in the bill.
You believe that?
I believe they will do it. Their letter to us is that they would do it to impact from July through the end of this year. And then they would take another look at the end of this year based on experience to state what the rating should be. And that's the big catch-22, because if they're going to file the new rates for next year based on experience, the experience obtained under this bill will not be in anybody's records, right? So that's the big fear everybody has, is you're going to have a 5.7% rate reduction from July till December, and then the new rates coming in effect next year will be based on experience, which will not reflect anything in this bill. That's the reason for the sentence on 27 through 29 on page 32.
Over the last 2 years, Alaskan companies had an increase of 40% or approximately there. Why did you guys pick 5.7? Why didn't you pick 11.4?
Well,
25% of that increase over the 2 years.
We picked 6, Mr. Chairman. The 5.7 comes from the commission that the NCCI, National Council of Compensation Insurance, they have a rating commission that rates, I believe. The testimony we had from John Lewis and others have said 6 to 10. There was actually some discussion by Representative Barnes and Taylor and Cotton on the committee to go to 10% mandated rate reduction. But we felt just to be conservative, we'd stay at 6 because that's what they said they were going to implement and that's what they would recommend, that we have hard dollar decrease of 6, and anything over that's going to be how much of these soft dollar factors are implemented. So we hope it'll be 10, but from what everybody's testified, we're fairly assured it'll be at least 6.
Representative Wallace?
Some of the uncertain effects of the bill is that it adopts a method of determining compensation based on percent of disability rather than on loss earnings. Could you tell me the rationale behind that?
It's a major change dealing with the unscheduled injuries, which are the major injuries to the head, back, neck. The rest of them are scheduled, and it's an attempt to put more certainty into the system so that people would know and to decrease the amount of litigation. A lot of litigation is over what future earning capacity really is. And I guess I would ask Jackie to come up here if you want to get into a more detailed discussion so I don't start wondering off. This was another area that was heavily discussed. And,
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jackie McClintock, Director of the Workers' Compensation Division. To respond to Representative Wallace's question, the intent of the ad hoc committee was to, Representative Sunda stated, to take away the, particularly on the litigation issues, issue of trying to predict what somebody's future loss of earning capacity is going to be. It's a very difficult shot to make and subject of a lot of litigation. So in studies that have been made as to physical disability, your whole man physical disability, tracking pretty well what your future loss of earning capacity is, the committee said okay, we're going to go through the whole man theory to particularly save on the nation issue and to more properly, they feel, one of the main effects of doing this is that the dollar, the committee believes, has been more distributed to the person that is severely injured away from the person that are paying for the person's whole man impairment.
Another uncertain effect in the bill is that the workman's comp board decisions are given more weight and data more weight so that supposedly they have less litigation. However, litigation is usually to the benefit of the worker. So I guess the question would be, does the bill allow workers to seek court litigation, you know, other than the workman's comp?
I'm not necessarily certain that litigation is to the benefit of the worker. I think, that there's all kinds of reasons for litigating, but I think that the certainty is better for everybody, that knowing what you're going to get, getting it in a rapid period of time, is better off than the unknown world of litigation. And I guess certainty of what the facts are. I think the litigation, in my concept, should be restricted to the issues of law and not the issues of fact. And we want the board to find out what the facts are, and then if they don't apply them correctly, make some bad judgments there, then they can litigate it. But that would be my feeling on it. I don't know, Jackie, what the ad hoc committee felt on that issue, but that was the whole attempt here, was to cut the uncertainties out.
And I think the committee also felt that rather than distributing dollars to litigation fees, that those dollars were better spent. I agree with Representative Dunn. It's necessarily that an injured worker comes out better going through the litigation process, which you...
Hey, that's not my question. I'm not debating whether or not it's good or bad. I'm just saying, can a worker go to the courts if it's not satisfied with the board?
They can, but there's nothing to stop them. We haven't said you can't litigate, but what we have done in the bill is say two things. One, that the facts found by the board shall be accepted by the court unless there's clear and convincing evidence that a reasonable person could not have arrived at that decision. So that's a pretty strong standard for the court to come back and say, you made the wrong factual findings. Secondly, in the findings section in page one of the bill, we've said that both parties shall be treated equally, which is another... If it's not one of these, if everything else is equal, the employee gets the call. That's a major change in the philosophy.
Third major concern I have and heartburn with the bill is on page 26. It's on line 15 and 16. Making the determination the market for the employee's service, area of residence, area of last employment, state of residence, and the state of Alaska. And my concern with that is it's the only obvious difference in the bill on the effect of rural and urban area as it relates to employment opportunities. If a worker is employable in any community, not as now, just their own community, they may be ineligible for total disability claims.
Same thing.
Now, if I was an insurance company, I would be delighted with this, because then if I was working in Fairbanks and went back to Fort Yukon because I'd been injured in receiving insurance, and there was no work available in Fort Yukon, and I tell them there's no work available, they would cut off my insurance right now and say, you have the opportunity to go somewhere else and find employment. And so could you respond to that? I know that there's no rural representation in the committees at this passed through, and maybe it was noticed, but...
Oh, it was noticed. this is an issue that was debated, and I guess, Jackie, I'll let you start with why the task force thought they put it in there, and then I'll comment on why the committee left it there, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, in the first place, the board already takes into consideration, of course, the place the person lives, and if I'm living in Juneau, and I'm, of course, the labor market would have been in Juneau, current law. However, you do have those cases where the people live in one area and have worked in another area, say on the pipeline, where they lived in many different communities but worked up on the pipeline. And decisions have been made that also the place of employment can also be considered their labor market area, simply because that's where they worked before. So even though they wanted to go back to the community to live where they lived before, because they work in a community that was not the same as a residence, that labor market could still be there. The thing that's been added is that it goes to the state of Alaska at large, and it also goes to state of residence, and particularly for those cases the people live outside the state. The reason that was put in is that the board committee wanted to make, I guess, a similar type of comparison to if a person was unemployed and lived in a remote community, would that person go to a larger community like Fairbanks, work available in their labor market, or would that person continue to live, say, in Fort Union? So that was one of the first aspects they looked at, and it was an attempt, yes, to say if a person chooses to live in a place like Fort Yukon or whatever, and there is no type of employment there that they have a labor market for, that particularly under the provision that you have called out is permanent total disability, but that doesn't make that permanent total disability. That the labor market is expanded to see that there's other areas that they can continue to go back to, just as if they were unemployed.
I understand you perfectly, but I also, I'm saying,
There's two areas in here. There's one on page 12, too, Representative Wallace, that deals in the same thing, and that's under the voc rehab section where there's that same litany or long list of where do you look to say when has a person been rehabilitated to a level acceptable to, so you could say this person's available to go to work. Do you have to be, if you're a logger living in Wrangell and you're injured and you can no longer be a logger and you're rehabilitated to some other skill level that, you have the ability to be a computer programmer or an accountant or a locksmith is a common one. You have the ability to be a locksmith, but there's no jobs in Wrangell as locksmithing. Can you stay in Wrangell and say, keep rehabilitating me until I have achieved a level of which there's a job available in Wrangell? Or is it the fact that the employer, the company can say, or society can say, well, you're rehabilitated enough to go to work at a job level, which is 75% of your prior wage, but the job you have to go to, or is it 60%
yes,
in that?
Yes, it's the employer that had the 75%.
Okay, 60%, but there's a job available in Juneau, or there's a job available in Anchorage. You've got to go, or we don't have to pay anymore. This is not a full employment retirement act. This is workers' comp is designed that if you're injured on the job, that you will be rehabilitated to be able to go back to work. And that's a policy call. And it's a big policy call. And it goes area of last residence, area of last employment, state of residence, which could be out of state if we have an out-of-state employee injured here, and then state of Alaska. And it progressively goes down that list.
If a rural person should become disabled and be unable to perform a job in their own community or still employable in another community, they would no longer be entitled to benefits that they're currently eligible to receive. In my mind, and I don't know about yours, but this is clearly an unfair advantage for insurance. What it does is makes everybody, virtually everybody employed, doing something somewhere. Now, if they were to say, oh, there's a job available in Fairbanks, is that, and we're going to cut off your insurance, Is that a guaranteed job? How many other people are employed in Fairbanks looking for that type of job? For most people who live and work in rural Alaska, relocating to urban areas where there may be a possibility of jobs, or may or may not be, is not an acceptable option because of the risk that you're running of moving in. Whereas, moving the whole family and all that, the lifestyles and cultures in many rural Alaskans and most Native Alaskans revolve along their relationship, you know, with the land and their family. So I'm saying that there isn't any work available in their town. They're saying to move out. This reminds me of a case that was held in Anchorage. Maybe somebody else knows more about it. But a fellow from the Bethel area was using a gun. The gun exploded. And the manufacturer was sued. And upon concluding how much they should be compensated for, one of the expert witnesses said, well, he only needs $50,000. He may have lost his eye, but he only needs $50,000 because we can relocate him from his village and outlying Bethel. We can relocate him to Anchorage, and for $50,000, I can find him a job. The $50,000 would cover relocation expenses and a job. But this was a lifelong, you know, hurt. He could no more live in his village to the level that he had previously, because now with one eye, it affected his being able to run a boat. It affected his hunting skills, etc. But I just see the same thing happening here, that you're going to tell somebody to move into Fairbanks, and sure, there may be jobs available, but the competition for those jobs doesn't make it realistic for the fellow applying for it. So, but all the insurance company has to say is, we know of a job in Anchorage. Go to Anchorage and get that job. We cut off your insurance right now.
I you raise a very fundamental philosophical issue with workers' compensation, and this bill doesn't change the basic thesis of that it's to make a certain award. In your case, loss of one eye, I think under, if I read this right, under current law is about $28,000, and under this law you would get $32,400 as your permanent partial disability award. You'd get your medical costs till you reach medical stability, and any ongoing medical for the rest of your life, basically. But that's what you would get in compensation, and you'd have the right to go into a voc rehab program, which would be limited to $10,000 to rehabilitate you into some other work level that would at least achieve 60% of your prior wages. And the philosophy is, does life guarantee you a job? And the answer to that is no. And is workers' compensation designed to guarantee you a job for the rest of your life after you're injured? The answer to that is no. This is designed to take care of your medical injuries, medical costs after you've been injured, to try to help rehabilitate you if you can't go back to the job that you had, into another job, but not necessarily at 100% of the wages, only at the 60% level. And if the voc rehab isn't enough, this award, you have to use part of this award to invest into the retraining of your future. And then you're back in a job market somewhere in the world. Basically, we start with where you were, where you live, the state, other states. But workers' comp is not designed to say that if you're injured in your town, you have a guaranteed check coming until you get back to where you were making as much money in the area where you want to live in your town, or else. This system never did do that, and this bill doesn't do it. I understand where you're coming from, but I'll tell you that workers' compensation does not do that.
I just add one more thing, is that the person that would be, if they said that they had some kind of labor market in Fairbanks, that labor market would have to be a true labor market and jobs available for that type of person that would be moving, say, from Fort Yukon into Fairbanks. And again, the only thing I can say is that you just kind of have to also look as to if the person were unemployed from a decline in the labor market without the injury, what would that person be doing?
It's a true replacement. It's not a just here's a job, right? I mean, it has to be, the theory is that it's a job that's there, and it's not going to last a week, and then you're unemployed. But You're asking some real deep philosophical questions as the whole workers' comp system. I can guarantee you that. And this bill does treat some of them, but doesn't treat them all.
Can you relate to what I'm trying to get
at? Yes, very much.
Can you relate to a village versus going in? I mean, going out of state? I mean, come on. We live and die here.
Excuse me.
I think the PPD doesn't send you out of state. It's if you didn't come from out of state, but it does look to the whole state as a job. Yeah.
I can't. I have no. You know, I can live with workers' comp. I can see the need for it and everything, but I can't. I can't see the reasons, and you haven't convinced me of why you changed it. You know, previously it was just in their own community, and now you've changed it worldwide, or United States-wide. I think this is a real urban and rural thing here, and I don't feel like you've addressed it.
Why this new language was put in here? I didn't put it in there. It was in there, but I would venture to say it's put in there to hold down the cost of workers' compensation. It's one of the cost factors that's trying to be reduced.
Through the chairs, do you have any records, statistics, data, or indications of that this that people in rural Alaska are indeed abusing the system, that they're not going back to work, that they're just taking insurance money and doing as you indicated?
We didn't receive any testimony on that issue, no.
But there have been board decisions that have addressed a problem, say in Southeastern, where a person had been working at a job in a very small community and was injured on the job, and that was a one-of-the-type job. I remember one in particular at Thorn Bay, and that was the only type of job there, and very long, lengthy litigation because they were not able to find a job like the person had before. There are cases like that. There's not any kind of statistics or numbers or dollars that we have added up. Glad to get some
through the chair. I can see, well, if there's only one job of a kind, then you go into voc training to get retrained for another job. Yes, I can see that, but it still doesn't. You know, my concern with this in on, you know, page 26, I'd like to delete that in the state of Alaska, just because of what I can see what it will be doing to, you know, people in urban Alaska. If you go home back to your village to recuperate, to you know, mend and come back out again and rethink your life goals, your life occupation, what's going to happen. I can see people going back home, but as soon as they go back to their village where there's limited amount of jobs, then they're going to be cut off with
Mr. Chairman, the other benefits can very well continue. Medical, of course, benefits would continue. The benefits for permanent partial disability under this new bill, because everything is rated on a percentage. It's not employment. It is the impairment to your body that they would be paying on. So any kind of temporary total disability until medical stability, after that, permanent partial disability based on the impairment to your body that the injury has caused, and any kind of medical benefits. On page 26, what it excludes is permanent total disability. If you do not take these areas into consideration, labor market and also the vocational rehabilitation, by taking those areas into consideration out of your employment where you previously had employment or the area of residence. So it's only vocational rehabilitation and permanent total disability that are affected by those provisions. It's not the other benefits.
I guess the question, Mr. Chairman, would be to say that if your proposed amendment, Representative Wallace, is on page 26, line 6, to delete subsection 4 there, the state of Alaska, is that what your proposal?
Page 26, line 16.
Oh, line 16, yeah, it's been cut off here, yeah. What would be the impact of deleting that section out and just leaving it so that you got to look at area of residence, area of last employment, or the state of residence? I'm not sure anybody here has a dollar number they can put on that, but my guess is that the impact would be to increase the amount of benefits paid and therefore decrease the any resultant cost savings that you're going to get in the bill. That's a policy call. I mean, it's just a pure question. I mean, you can cut the cost of this system down to zero if you want to, right? You can keep. But I'm just, you're asking me. It's a policy call. I don't have a real opinion on it. I understand exactly what you're saying, and it doesn't apply just to Fort Yukon going to Fairbanks. It applies to Craig, Heidelberg, Kluwak. In this case, Thorn Bay is a logging community in southeast. It applies to people in Wrangell who don't want to go to Anchorage. So it's an issue.
And again, I keep on belaboring, but it's only permanent total disability. If a person is saying they can't do anything, it doesn't affect your temporary total disability, benefits while you're getting well, your medically stable, or permanent partial, your impairment to the body. It's in this section, it's just for permanent total disability, which means you can't do anything. Of benefits you get. And of course, the vocational rehabilitation, $10,000.
Jefferson Frank.
Thank you. On that, you're saying it's only for permanent total disability. That means the situation would be where, if you did live in Wrangell and there were no jobs that you were capable of doing, then you would be considered permanently totally disabled. Okay, but there might be a job you could function in Anchorage, and so if you chose not to go to Anchorage, then your payments would be cut off.
Right.
Okay.
For permanent total disability, you're still going to get the percentage of impairment for permanent partial.
Yeah, okay.
You're going to get your percentage of impairment, and if you have any ongoing medical, you're going to continue to get your medical. It's just saying that it's your choice. You know, you're permanently total. I mean, maybe you lost an arm and a leg, and or you lost some part of your body. You're impaired so that you can no longer function in a job that's available in your community, let's say Wrangell. But there is a job that you could function in Anchorage. Okay. What this bill is saying, it's your choice. If you want to stay in Wrangell, we're not going to pay you your PPD check, because there's an opportunity for you to get back in the workforce if you went to another city.
Can I continue with a couple other questions? If you are permanently disabled to the point where you can't find employment that would pay you 60% of your prior wage, then that is permanent total disability? I'm sorry.
No, okay. There's several places where the 60% comes in. What that portion is in the eligibility for vocational rehabilitation benefits. And the standard is if you've been retrained that you could go back to work, it's called remunerative employability. If you've been retrained that you can go back 60% of your prior wage, then you are employable. And yes, then in that token, you would not be a permanent total disability.
Okay. So let's say that you could only get, let's say you were a logger, or let's say you were something and you could earn $25 an hour, and now you could only earn 10. I mean, the best job they could find for you was $10 an hour. What happens to you in that case?
What happens, first of all, is that they put you in a vocational rehabilitation system, considering that you meet the other criteria that's in there. But you go into a vocational rehabilitation system, they would look at labor markets and other places other than your residence or where you're working, and you would go through a vocational rehabilitation system to become employed. And if once you reach that 60%, that you could go back to work, then you could be employed. That's under the definition of renewal. But you're trained first to return to the workforce.
But my situation,
Carrie's situation, you've gone through voc rehab.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And you still are.
You're only 50%.
You're still at
$10. You're below 50% or something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Then it's possible that you'd be permanently total.
Okay. And under that situation, you would be eligible for what benefits?
It's whatever your compensation rate is for a total disability for the rest of your life, or until the disability.
And that's based upon your
prior wages.
Right. Prior wages. What was it? 200% of your prior wage.
No, it's now a minimum of $154 a week, a max of $700 a week. But your average weekly wage, taking your two prior years, and figuring what your compensation rate is.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to be brief. On the 60% and the other percentages, is it possible to, I guess the way it's phrased is, if you have private insurance, lots of times you can sign up for disability insurance, you know, just privately. Are those additive, or does that have to be deducted from your benefits on here?
Mr. Chairman, there's no deduction under workers' compensation that can be made from your benefits except Social Security, and Social Security is taken because if the workers' comp doesn't take it, then Social Security will. And under this, there's a new provision now that will add vested union benefits into your average weekly wage for purposes of figuring your comp rate. If those are added in, then by the same percentage, they can be taken out.
Okay.
But there's no collateral.
Subrogation or whatever you call it. Okay.
The
other questions I had were on page 11, line 24, where the employee has to participate in any planned reemployment activity as determined by the administrator. Is it safe to assume that there is a test of reasonableness in that? What if you have an administrator that just dictates some arbitrary thing you have to do? You know?
Well, the issue did come up, and one, this is a voluntary system where the employee has agreed to this plan. He's agreed to the aspects of the plan, and this is basically to say that after he's agreed, and if you see on line 14, non-cooperation means unreasonable failure.
Okay.
So there is a test there.
Okay.
And there is, this does provide for a voc rehab administrator to be work for the board to help set this voc rehab.
Great. And the last question I had, back on section 2 on the assigned risk, could you give me an example, explain how that works? Maybe this is on page 2, lines 18 through 25. Let's just say that your premium before a surcharge was $100, and then you've got something called an experience modification debit and a surcharge. What goes down and what goes up, and what's...
We're going to bring the assigned risk pool expert to the table here, Mr. Okay. Chairman. We have a variety of experts on this issue. Okay. Sherry, why don't you... Sure.
Take $100 and work me forward from there.
Okay. Okay. For the record, I'm Sherry Kochman, Age Representative Sund. Somebody's got $100 premium right now. Is that what you're asking?
Well, however, it says the insurer may not impose a surcharge on something. So I want to know is...
Okay, the way the assigned risk pool works right now, the correct term is surcharge, based on your premium. If you have a premium rate of $100, meaning that that classification employer,
right,
the base rate in the market at large is $100,
okay,
nobody will write you because it's a low premium.
Okay.
You're dumped with the assigned risk pool. You're going to pay $120 because you're getting a 20% surcharge on that $100 premium rate.
Is that the surcharge referred to here, or is it?
Correct. Okay. That's present law. It's a 20% surcharge.
Okay.
Now, in addition, in the world of workers' comp rating, there's also what's called an experience modification. That is based on your actual experience over usually a two-year period. And it's going to come out as either a debit for showing bad experience, you've been a higher risk than the average, the norm, the base, or a credit, meaning you're a better risk, so you're going to get a rebate or a reduction on your premium. Not a rebate, I should say a reduction on your premium. Okay, the way it works now is companies with less than $2,500 in premium are not experience rated because it's just not worth the insurance company's time to do that. Those low premiums are not profitable. So that's one reason why you're dumped in the assigned risk pool. It's just not worth it to write you, okay? And you're also not experience rated. So you go in the assigned risk pool, you may have a clean record, as Representative Sunder said earlier, but you automatically get that surcharge. What this amendment does is say if you're not experience rated, you cannot be subject to the surcharge. So it's going to do a couple of things. It's either going to force the insurance companies to rate you, or if they still feel it's not worth their time to rate you, those smaller companies, those lower premiums, they just won't be surcharged. What it's in effect doing is taking you out of the pool and putting you in the voluntary market, but while you're still in the pool. It's treating you like the voluntary market, but we can't take you out of the pool because you can't make somebody write an employer. You can't say, insurance company A, you must take this business. So you're still in the pool because you can't force them out. But in effect, you're not in the pool.
Because you can't be charged any surcharge.
Because you're not going to surcharge. Now, if I may go further with the way the credit and the debit works, what it's saying further from that, okay, say you do get an experience modification after a couple of years of experience, and say it's accredited.
10%.
Correct. So you're 10%. You're now at a 10% credit off of your premium. If the way the pool works now still kicked in. That means you get a 10% reduction on your base rate, but now you're subject to the surcharge. So you get a 20% surcharge above that, so your net effect is a 10% increase. We felt that wasn't fair. You should be rated based on your actual experience. So this is saying if you get an experience modification credit, you're still not subject to the surcharge. So the net effect is you're still being treated as if you weren't even in the pool. The debit surcharge that comes in, if you truly have a debited experience modification factor.
Debit means bad or good?
Debit means bad.
Okay.
So now let's say for that $100, let's go back to $100 premium.
Right.
Now they're saying you have to pay 10% more because you're a bad risk. Okay. You find your experience modification is 10%. So now you're paying 110. Under this bill, instead of just tacking on another 20% surcharge, we're saying the surcharge will be equal to that percentage of debit. So you had a 10% debit, bringing your rate to 110. Now we're going to tack on a 10% surcharge, another $11. So you're now going to be paying $121. And we capped that surcharge at 25%. We increased it from the present 20 to 25 in an attempt to offset some of the loss we're going to make on the bottom end where we're going to lose the surcharges. Granted, you're not going to make up for it purely with that added 5%. So the way that cap of 25 works is say a company comes in with a 50% debit rating, they still would only get a 25% surcharge tacked on above that, above and beyond that, 175% of the rate.
So the net effect, I think I understand how this is going to squeeze down some rates, but the way the system works, I mean, when something goes down, something pops up. Who pays the higher rate? The other people in the assigned risk pool to make up that difference, or the people outside of the assigned risk pool?
Probably the voluntary market outside of the assigned risk pool. Probably. But Milliman and Robertson did look at this amendment, and it is, I think, on page 3 of your report.
Okay.
And I provided the Milliman report. And I believe they said it would only be about a 0.6% increase, if I'm reading that correctly, which to me doesn't sound like too bad of a deal. The point here, I think, is, if I may go this far, Mr. Chairman, as far as the small employers in the state, I really think this amendment does more to help them. It would give them a 20% reduction almost immediately.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Yes.
Chairman, you're looking for a motion?
I'm looking for a motion. I hear the bells.
Finance Committee report out. It's SB 322, Judiciary Committee individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to moving out House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill number 322, Judiciary, with a fiscal note with individual recommendations? Hearing no objections, that bill has been moved out of committee.
I'm sorry.
Hey, John, I got a question for you.
Keep me in line.
I know.
Here.
They got a report.
Yeah. I have a headache this morning. No? No. He's got to wear the band-aid strap that holds his shoulder back like that. Well, maybe it's just cracked or something. At daycare or something. They just... He was playing in second time.
Robert, can you please run next?
But of course, you have to realize that's a problem.
I have signed it.
It depends on what the percentage
is over there.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yes, ma'am.
I will talk to Peter.
Who's one of them?